Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 238 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me as co-host is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening, and tonight I'm in beautiful San Diego. I think that's in California, because the weather is very nice here. Well, at least compared to Chicago, where I left just in time to leave behind 6 inches of snow for my wife and my daughter.
I bet they're pleased with that. Now, you're at a conference in San Diego.
Yes, I'm at the National Business Aviation Association's International Operators Conference, which is for basically flight departments that conduct tons of international operations from the U.S. To other parts of the world. So it's pretty exciting, actually, when you hear about the differences between how the aviation systems run in other countries versus ours.
Oh, I'm sure. Are you going to be able to talk about that a little bit later in the episode, or should we wait till next week for the whole show to go through?
I'm kind of a shy guy, so I
sure.
If I could say anything, but no, I'll give you guys a little bit of an update.
Okay.
Because we only just finished day one, so.
Yeah, it's just getting started. Well, our other co-host, David Vanderhoof, unfortunately will not be with us this episode. At least we don't think so. There's a slight possibility. He's on the phone right now with tech support for his internet service provider, and hopefully he'll get back online sometime soon. If it's really soon, then he may be able to join us in progress, but otherwise we'll look for David next week.
I think we should tweet at Comcast or something, or whatever that magic Twitter handle is.
That's right.
See if they'll do anything for him.
Tell him to get David fixed up back online.
Yeah. No, he's married. I don't think he wants to be fixed up.
You know what I mean. Our guest this episode is Harriet Baskus. Harriet's a regular contributor for NBCNews.com Travel and MSNBC Travel. She also reports on airports and air travel in a monthly column for USA Today. She also has work that appears in the AAA Journey, which I get, actually. I'm going to have to go back on some old back episodes, Harriet, and see if I can find you in there. And she's also got a blog, Stuck at the Airport. com. Harriet, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Now, this is going to be fun because there's a lot of interesting things that we can talk about with you. But one thing that I noticed that I wasn't aware of before is you're responsible for the USA Today airport guides.
That's right.
Now, there's a lot of guides out there. Did you put all those together?
You know, funny, I used to do guides for Expedia when they had original content there, and I had more than over 100 guides there. And then when that stopped, we put just 50, the 50 top airports in the U.S. on USA Today.
And where do you get the information from those? Because they're updated from time to time, aren't they?
Yes. I talk directly to 25 airports every month. So every other month, they get a direct call from me or an email bugging them to talk to me.
Wow.
Yeah, but I would think a really good gig would be I must travel to these 25 airports.
Yes, to get that's what I used to do.
Update.
That's what I used to do for Expedia. And I started doing that before 9/11, when you could go anywhere in an airport, and I would do two or three in a day.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Or a weekend and just walk the airports, but you can't really do that anymore.
I think that's a blast. Not all of your writing, of course, is centered around airports. You do some other things as well. But airports certainly play a big part of the work that you write. Why is that? Where did this interest in airports come from? Or did you just sort of fall into it?
I kind of just fell into it. I do a lot of radio, and I used to travel around going to do stories about unusual museums and visiting and consulting with community radio stations around the country. And I live in Seattle. I'm kind of a city kid. And I was in Kentucky in the woods helping a radio station, and I got kind of homesick. So I said, I'll just finish up early and go to the airport and go home early. And I went to the airport, gave back my rental car, went inside, thought I would get on the next plane, which didn't turn out to be for 8 hours.
Oh, wow.
And by the time 8 hours was over, I knew everything about that airport. And by the time I got home, I decided there needed to be a guide to everything to do in every airport. for wow. people in that situation.
That's fantastic. That's a great story.
Yeah.
And I told my husband I was going to do that, and he said that was the stupidest thing he ever heard. And so that's how I do it.
So that's why you do it.
I was going to say the same thing. So that made you definitely want to do it.
Absolutely.
But I saw some great pictures. I forgot exactly what it was, but it named you as one of the important people in travel or something. But it had pictures of you when you were very young, and also one when you were a young lady at a radio station, I think. And it was really cool stuff. So you've been involved in this aviation and communication stuff for I won't say a long time, but
a long time.
I didn't want to put it that way.
Yeah.
Good. We're going to talk with Harriet some more about that coming up. First, we've got some aviation news we're going to talk about. Yeah, because David is away, we're going to miss his history segment this episode, but we'll look for him next time. We do have an Australia desk report from Grant and Steve. They're fresh back from Avalon. And in fact, their report just came in probably 10, 15 minutes ago. So we'll listen to that in a little bit as well. And we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. Peter's actually talking with an airport fire service. So I don't know that it was planned that way, but Peter's going to be able to kind of continue the theme for this episode. And we have another listener recording telling the story of how they got interested in aviation, how they developed a passion for aviation. We've been getting quite a number of them come in. This is really fantastic. And so we'll probably do one or two a week for as long as folks keep sending those in. And then we'll finish up with some of the listener mail that we've received lately. But first, we've got some aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
I'm ready.
We have a couple of news items concerning JetBlue. The first one is from Flight Global. This is JetBlue unveils first A320 with sharklets. Sharklets, huh? Well, Airbus has started delivering A320s with what they call sharklets. These are also called winglets sometimes, and they increase aircraft efficiency by reducing the tip vortex drag. If you're into aerodynamics, there's actually some interesting physics associated with this, but you've seen them on many planes, increasingly so. Sometimes there's also blended winglets, and those have a curve between the joint between the wing and the winglet. Boeing aircraft, especially the 737, have these. Sometimes you see winglets that are, they extend above and below the wing, and those are called a wingtip fence. But other times there's sort of a different approach. If you look at the 787, you'll notice that there isn't a winglet. Instead, they have what you would call a raked wingtip, which really accomplishes pretty much the same thing as a winglet or a sharklet. But sharklet is what Airbus calls their version of a blended winglet. So JetBlue has retrofitted sharklets onto their first A320, and this is something that they expect to keep doing for the already delivered aircraft that they have, the A320s they have, and all future A320s will come with these. But it's another way to get increased efficiency and less fuel consumption on a jetliner and other things too. Rob, we see these things in all kinds of airplanes, not just large jets.
That's correct. And I think one of the interesting aspects of the sharklets is that they are only on Airbuses, as opposed to other airplanes of the, that Boeing persuasion and other kinds that have winglets. And, of course, there's a bit of a dispute there between Aviation Partners and the Airbus people about shark winglets with a new name. So that I don't quite think that's been resolved yet, but I'll bet that's going to come back and haunt them.
Yeah, everybody seems to want to own or patent or trademark everything these days. But regardless of what you call them, these things are usually good for around a 3% fuel burn reduction. that allows you to either increase the range of the aircraft or increase the payload. The article has an interesting figure as to how much does this save. And JetBlue figures that these sharklets on the A320 are good for an annual savings of $350,000 per aircraft. So, you know, as you can see, that's going to add up pretty quickly for a good-sized fleet.
Well, of course, I think one thing that's interesting, too, is that most of the technology that I've read about, the winglets, slant sharklets, really talks about the fact that these devices really add more in long-range cruise than they do on short flights. So I'd be curious to see how JetBlue kind of came up with those numbers, and you know, as to that 350,000, because most of their, well, actually, they're not all. They have some long flights, actually. Now that I think about it, so, but you know, again, those are pretty much long distance toys to put on your wings.
I think this article says that, or at least something that I've read says that JetBlue's going to fly this particular aircraft, this first one that's been retrofitted between JFK and San Francisco twice a day. So that's a lot of airtime, a lot of distance. I imagine that Airbus probably helped with the calculation that led JetBlue to, you know, arrive at the $350,000 a year per aircraft number. It's you know, it's probably based on some data that Airbus provided.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah. There was another interesting item in the news recently concerning JetBlue, and we have an article. This is actually from Electronista.com that's titled "JetBlue Entry to Google Glass Contest Suggests Airport Usage." Rob, you know what Google Glass is?
I don't have a clue. That's why we have Harriet here.
Oh.
I hope she knows.
Well, I don't know exactly what Google Glass is, but I think it's like you can overlay information on what you see in front of you.
Right. That's pretty good. It's a wearable computing device. So it's a head-mounted thing with a little thing that sits in front of your eye. It's not really like glasses, I don't think, but it's almost like a heads-up display for your head. And the idea, Google's idea, is that, you know, information could be displayed and you could interact with this device the way you might with any other kind of a electronic device or a smartphone or something like that. So there's been prototypes out. I think Google has distributed some prototypes to some developers, but they have a contest to look at ways that you might use a device like this. So apparently JetBlue might have an entry for this contest because they've created some mock-ups of how this thing could be used for air travel. And they have a video, but some of the applications are things like showing the capacity of car parks at an airport or flight information. Or even things like you could query it, you know, I need to charge my phone or my laptop. Where's a charging station that I can get to?
And, of course, if you're in Chicago, the answer for O'Hare is practically nowhere.
Yeah. So, Harriet, this sounds like, you know, an application that really has a lot of potential for airport visitors.
Absolutely. I was thinking, you know, airports themselves are getting into the mobile apps and trying to communicate more with passengers who are coming. So I could see some of the concessions saying, oh, you're over here in Terminal A. We've got a deal on barbecue sandwiches over here in Terminal B. Come over here. The idea of telling you where the outlets are is really great, except where are they getting in that information, and would it know to tell you if somebody's already plugged in, mm-hmm. or if a pet peeve of mine, if the outlet itself is turned off, which happens a lot.
Is that right?
Yes. I've been in airports where, you know, there's the outlets that are built into the patch of the pod of seats.
Yep.
And then the whole seats aren't plugged in. So you're sitting there, you know, it just doesn't work. So I like that idea because you don't always know that there's a plug behind that guy sitting over there that you could access. And it could also perhaps tell you if you're on one security line that the one on the other side of the airport has nobody at it.
Mm.
Oh, who cares about the security line? All I want to know is which food line is going to move faster other than when I stand, you know, I change lines and then, of course, that's the one that ends up going slower.
If it could tell you what's in the food or how many calories
ordered.
There's all kinds of possibilities. Yeah, yeah. You know, when you're walking through an airport, sometimes it's kind of easy to tell the seasoned travelers from the folks who don't travel that frequently. Seasoned travelers, I think, you know, you get to know the airport, obviously, but for a lot of people, they don't have that interaction with the airport. And something like this, I think, would be especially helpful to somebody in that category, or somebody who's just not comfortable in knowing where to go and what to do and where they should be and all that. I would think this would be a great draw for those kind of people.
Sure. If you show up at an airport, and even if you know that airport, but this time you age and you usually don't, and you don't know the route there, it could literally lead you there with like a green line that says go this way.
So you're saying that in addition to these goofy glasses would make someone, how much geekier would these make someone that is also wearing one of those little earplugs, you know, the headphone jacks that they wear all the time? So they'd have geeky glasses and geeky earplugs. And wouldn't that say I'm not an experienced traveler or I am an experienced traveler? I don't know. It's just wondering.
The nice thing about airports is there are all sorts of people who look all sorts of ways. And that's what makes it interesting to hang out there, to be stuck at the airport.
That's
my favorite thing is just people watching. So some of them are geeks, some of them aren't.
That's right. It's a great place for that.
Now, and if the airplane, these Google glasses could have told me yesterday when I flew out from O'Hare that the power plugs on this American 737-800, a new airplane, didn't work, I could have, tried to move my seat or something. But, you know, and the trouble is with something like that is that people kind of plan it. They think, well, I'll get 3 or 4 hours of work. They didn't have their laptop charged to the hilt before they got on the airplane, they'd be in some serious trouble.
So just the last question I have about those glasses is, so they would be an electronic device that you would have to turn off on the airplane most of the time, right?
It sounds that way. I got to believe that's the case. I mean, they have to be connected to the internet in order to function, I think. So that's a good point. That's a really good point. But, you know, I think JetBlue's got a winner here. I don't know what the prize is, but I think JetBlue's really got this one nailed. All right, we'll come back, talk about airports some more, but first a couple other stories. One is on this UK air accident investigation onto the January London helicopter accident. And, Rob, this was an accident. This was an Augusta 109E, right? It struck a building crane in London.
Yeah, this is the one that people may have seen just over a month ago. It crashed in the middle of rush hour in London, in the morning rush hour, and it's pretty clear that even the preliminary report seems to indicate that the weather was so bad that nobody in his right mind would have been flying practically IFR in an airplane, let alone trying to stay beneath the clouds in a helicopter. Mm. And the pilot just lost visual reference to what was going on around him. And he was circling out near the Westminster Bridge, trying to get a clearance into the Battersea helicopter port there, a heliport in London. And the cloud bases were 100 feet, which means that's 100 feet off the water. And then you have to have some maneuvering room in there somewhere. So he didn't have a whole lot of room for error there. And the visibility was less than half a mile. And he made a turn and he hit the crane because the crane and part of the building was obscured by the clouds. And, it's a sad situation. But the data shows even here in the United States that one of the major causes of accidents in helicopters is when pilots fly these things into weather that is worse than VFR. Practically, this was at IFR minimums, let alone, you know, less than VFR. I mean, most instrument airplanes would have trouble landing in 1/103 of a mile.
So do we know what the pilot was thinking? Was it just, you know, bravado or the challenge?
Well,
or?
You know, it's a funny thing. This kind of a helicopter wouldn't have had a flight data recorder, so we don't really know for certain, except that he was talking to London Approach Control there, and he had what sounded like normal conversations, and he didn't seem to be terribly concerned, and all of a sudden they were gone, and the helicopter struck the crane, and then it fell to the ground there near St. George Wharf, and it killed a pedestrian when the wreckage hit the ground. So there were two people that lost their lives in this accident.
Really unfortunate. All right. We want to just follow up on an item from last time. This was concerning the F-35 fighter being grounded. And we have a report from Reuters. Pentagon says to resume F-35 flights. And just to follow up, we noted last week that the fleet was grounded because a crack was found in a turbine blade. And this article points out that no cracks were found in the other planes. And after testing by the manufacturer Pratt & Whitney, they determined that the crack was the result of, well, hot flight tests, I guess, that it was not a high cycle fatigue crack issue, which was kind of the worst case scenario. There's a quote here. The engine in question had operated at high temperatures for more than four times longer than a typical F-35 flight. So I guess this was kind of a, I don't know if you'd call this a stress test or not, Rob, but they kind of lit this thing up a lot. The crack in the blade was the result of that.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about stress test, it was probably a stress test for the Pentagon because, this airplane has, it's the military version sometimes of the poor 787 issues. And I was just telling somebody here a little while ago that building airplanes is not easy anymore. So many systems can fail. But again, I think that once they found out that was just a random crack, I'm sure that made everybody feel a little bit better. Let's see, I forgot. How much did these things cost us a piece, Max? What are these, about $300 million or something?
Each time the volume goes down, the development costs get spread over fewer number of aircraft, so the unit price keeps going up. But that's the way it is. Yeah, you mentioned the 787. I wonder, Harriet, you know, in your experience and your travels and so forth, are you finding that the flying public is kind of attuned to the 787 problems? Do you think there's any impact out there, or is this just something that, well, obviously the airlines themselves, but also, you know, kind of enthusiasts and people in the industry are concerned with? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think people were hearing so much about it. Every time an airline started, that the few airlines that got to start flying them flew one, there was big, you know, articles and stories, and then it kind of disappeared. So I think I've talked to people who are like, well, what about that? Or have you flown it, and would you fly it? So I think people are just expected it to be everywhere, and then they're just expecting to wait longer till it comes back around. I talked to someone who said, you know, a lot of people say, you know, any new machine, any new thing has to have a shakeout period. So some people I've talked to are like, well, this is just a shakeout, but that's a big shakeout.
Yeah, I think I would kind of agree with you there, Harry. And I think this is a pretty serious shakeout issue. Yeah. And I mean, whether, you know, not whether, but I'm sure Boeing will fix it. The question is when and at what cost?
Right. And will people trust it? I mean, sure. I flew, I think, one of the last couple of days before they grounded it. And I really liked it. And I felt safe. There was already some talk about problems, but I felt safe on it. So I would fly it again.
Harriet, what was it about the flight that you liked?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was trying to think about this. Anytime you fly in business class, you're going to arrive a little happier than if you do in economy.
Sure.
So I was in business class, so that was a, you know, kind of nicer, but it definitely had that feeling, you know, that they talk about. It definitely felt bigger. It definitely felt not as dry when you landed. It definitely, I mean, it was the first flight of an airline flying it, so everyone was in a party mood. But there were some people on that plane that didn't even know it was the 787. They had just booked a flight, and this just happened to be the first 787.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, people were like, I have to go to Santiago, so we're going. But
yeah. You know, but yeah, Harriet, go ahead.
I was going to say, I liked it, and I was looking forward to trying it again soon.
I want to ask you something about something you just said a minute ago about flying in an airplane when the atmosphere inside the airplane is very dry. And you said that you felt that was how long was the flight in the 787 when you flew?
It was from Los Angeles to Santiago, so I think it was 6 or 7 hours.
Oh yeah, good.
Yeah.
Because it's funny, and I hate to keep harping on my friends at American because I'm an Advantage member, guys. Just in case you're wondering, but this was the driest airplane I've ever experienced. By the time I got to San Diego, even though I'd consumed probably a good size bottle and a half of water, I mean a liter bottle, I mean I was still talking, I was kind of doing this, and other people were too. But as far as I knew, the crew didn't have any, or does not have any control over the humidity content of the air in those airplanes. But boy, it was rough.
It was dry. And the 787 operates with a higher cabin humidity, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's what they say. And I remember thinking, how do you know? How could you tell? How do you measure? How do you measure not being as tired? That's a hard. Mm. It's not a number, you know. But I think I felt it.
All right, just one last thing before we move on. I just wanted to mention this, that you know we've mentioned a few folks in the last few episodes or over the last few months that have lost their lives in aviation accidents. Wanted to mention that we've lost an individual who has appeared on this podcast as our guest, not through an aviation accident, I don't believe, but that's Brian Lusk from Southwest. And there have been a great many posts and on blogs and tweets and so forth. I think Brian was very much loved by his friends and associates and those who got to know him. And probably what I do is direct people to the Southwest blog. That's at blogsouthwest.com. And if you scroll down to, I'm not sure what the date is, but if you scroll down a bit, you'll find an article, a post, Flashback Friday's Farewell to a Friend. And you might want to add your comments there if you like, if you knew Brian. We also took the conversation we had with Brian way back in episode 156 of this podcast. That was published in July of 2011, and kind of edited it down to something that's sort of focused on Brian. And there's a link to that in my post under that Southwest blog, so just you could look for that. We'll probably put a link in the show notes to that if you'd like to listen to that, or you can go back to episode 156 and listen there.
Well, if I can just add one thing about Brian, because I probably knew him almost before anybody else that I've met down at Southwest, because Paula Berg, who used to be the social media goddess for Southwest, introduced me to Brian, oh gosh, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, something like that. But one thing I remember Brian doing, he had a great sense of humor, and he gave me one of those Southwest Airlines 737s that was a blow-up, kind of like you use those, you blow up toys for kids that are going in the swimming, and you could wear it as a hat. And so when I was down there for a media day, said, I've got to find somebody. He said, I know. There's only one guy in here that could wear a hat like this. And he came over to me and put it on my head. And I said, why me? But, you know, it's really a shame. I'm going to miss him because he used to come up to Air Venture in Oshkosh when Southwest brought their 737 up for the summer event. And it's just not going to be the same without him.
Condolences to Brian's family and all his friends. Again, we're speaking with Harriet Baskus. Harriet, you just recently attended an event, the Travel Goods Show in Las Vegas. What was that like?
That was so much fun. I actually went to Las Vegas to go to an airport conference. Airport Revenue News had a conference with a lot of concession people there talking about issues. And so the Travel Goods Show was the next day, so I went. So I think it used to be called the Travel and Leather Goods Show, but it was a giant convention hall filled with all sorts of suitcases and luggage and travel gear and travel accessories and some clothing that doubled as travel gear and it's clothing that doubled as suitcases. It was just really fun to go up and down the aisles checking out what people had. So much stuff that's not even in stores yet and won't be available till April, May, or at the end of the year.
Are there any trends in that area? I mean, are we seeing technology coming into those kind of items, or is it more about sort of visual and aesthetics?
It's everything. So many suitcases now, you just don't have a suitcase or a carry-on. You have to have a carry-on that has space for your electronic gear, your tablets, your laptops, and things like that. And one of the kind of almost the simplest, but I think the most useful thing that I saw for if you're going to be stuck at the airport is a carry-on case that has a little like slot in the top so that if you're sitting there at the gate in a chair and you want to look at your laptop, watch a movie, or do some work, you just put your tablet in the slot in the top of your carry-on and then you can use it.
Yeah, that sounds handy instead of having to open up the whole thing and dig it out.
Yeah, so you just hold it, just is a spot. They just realized this is how people use their suitcase. There's carry-ons you can sit on so that doubles as a chair in case you're in the gate area and there's no place to sit, things like that. So, yeah, so things that will let you kind of make sure you carry everything, make sure it's protected. So, you know, hard-sided for a long time, everyone carried soft-sided. So hard-sided is coming back because it protects things more. Everything's carry-on size because no one wants to check their bags. And then some of it is just really fun. The same company that has that carry-on with the slot in it, that's called the PodPal, has luggage the same size carry-on, but it's got Felix the Cat on it. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember Felix the Cat, but Felix the Cat had a magic satchel that was his bag of tricks.
That's right.
So I think that's a perfect match there.
That's pretty clever.
I really like that. Then there was can I just tell you about some of the other fun stuff I saw?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So just again, for people who travel a lot. So the pillows, the sleep pillows, this is kind of like a simple thing, low cost. The pillows that you see people wearing around their necks and they don't really work. People's heads still flop around. You can't find a spot. So there's this guy who decided he was going to improve on that. So he went home and he took like a headband and he duct taped a pair of socks to it and made his wife drive him around the neighborhood to see if this would be a better way to keep your head flat against the chair. So he came up, he's got something called the Travel Halo. And really it's like a little pillows on the back, little pillows that are perfectly spaced so you can lean against the back of a seat on an airplane or a car and get some sleep. And it has an eye mask that folds down or not. And it's just a lot less geeky than wearing a pillow around your neck that's not going to protect you or let you sleep anyway. So that one I really liked. And then things for this one, I think I would buy. It's being sold now for kids, but it's a carry-on with a little pop-out pod. So you take your carry-on in this like almost like a little briefcase. You put your carry-on up above, but then you've got this case that's filled with games and toys. And they say they're making one for adults so that you can put your papers or your laptop or your tablet in that pop-out pod, put your carry-on up on top, and then take this pod wherever you're going. So it's like a briefcase and a suitcase in one.
I thought you were going to say you put your kid in the pod.
So they should have stuff like that.
Unless, of course, the kids have parents who are wearing this pillow and the Google glasses and the earplug thing for their cell phone. And anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's quite a load to carry around. Huh?
Some very expensive things, but then some very simple things. There was a guy with almost like a folding table there, and he had this invention where instead of having to buy little tubes of toothpaste, which are as expensive as the big tubes of toothpaste, a little gadget where you could just refill a little tube of toothpaste from your big one and take it with you.
That appeals to cheap people like me, that's for sure. Yeah.
I like that idea.
Yeah. That's being frugal.
Yeah, or if you have a certain special toothpaste that you can't buy everywhere. So
That's a better that's better. Yeah. Yes, okay. That would be my reason.
So that was really fun.
Yeah.
And it made me want to throw away the worn ratty bag that I carry around.
Gee, you don't think that was part of their madness, do you?
Right. Yeah, I saw several things that I would like to buy when they're available.
You know, a lot of times, Harry, you see, well, not a lot of times, all the time you see sort of, I don't know, travel accessories and items like this for sale at the airport. How is that business at the airport? I mean, do they really sell a lot of those things? I mean, you don't always see people, you know, buying their luggage at an airport shop, but yet there it is.
That's funny you say that because I've just started collecting information to write a column on just that topic. I felt the same way. I felt like, who would buy luggage at the airport? Like, if you're going somewhere, you know, don't you have something?
Yeah, by then it's too late.
Yeah, by then it's too late. So I remember thinking, well, maybe your bag, you know, for people whose bags break, or maybe they buy some more things. But it turns out that it's for people who go shopping, like Orlando, for example. They said they just put in a new kind of high-end luggage shop in the airport, because it's a big shopping destination for people from Brazil, I think, are coming up, going to the very high-end stores, and then they need a piece of high-end luggage to take it home in.
Oh, well, that makes sense. I guess I can see that.
Yeah. So I'm going to do a little research and see where the hot spots are for luggage.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, what else is going on at airports? Are we seeing any kinds of trends or are airports trying anything new these days? You mentioned, you know, apps and things like that is I guess, one example.
Yeah. So the another thing I did right at the end of the year was kind of go back and look over the last year, 2012, what was new. And we all know that airports are finally realizing that not everyone wants McDonald's all the time. So they're putting in nicer restaurants, nicer bars, not just sports bars, but bars where ladies would feel comfortable having a drink.
Yeah.
So places where you want to linger, places where you want to plan a meal, places where you might feel comfortable a little extra to have a nice meal. That's a trend that's definitely going on. It's a trend. But one thing that I saw at the Denver airport this year, and in fact, I was stuck there for a couple of hours and sat there and watched it. They put in 200 landline telephones.
Landline?
Landline. So as most airports have taken out, you cannot find a payphone in a lot of airports anymore. But in Denver, they're free telephones. So you can walk up to these telephones and talk domestically, and you can talk for 10 minutes internationally for free. And it's an advertising thing. You have to, they'll show you a little ad, very short. But I sat there and watched people have forgotten to press the buttons on the telephone.
Oh, really?
So many people went up and you saw them touching the screen, getting frustrated and walking away when there was like buttons there. So that was, I don't know if that's a trend, but it's an advertising thing. in Las Vegas, I bet this will be a trend. In Las Vegas, it makes perfect liquor store, not a duty-free store, but it's on the baggage, in the baggage claim area. So you can start partying. You could get your supplies before you go to your hotel. And they say this liquor store is doing very, very well.
I saw recently, and I don't really recall exactly where it was, but I saw somebody that is producing or is going to produce these like sleeping pods, you know, small little boxes that you, I guess, rent by the hour or something. I'm not sure exactly.
There used to be more of them in airports. And then I think after 9/11, they went away. Like Honolulu used to have a nice little, like, I don't see if. When you say by the hour hotel, but there were short stay hotels for people with long layovers. So yeah, so Minute Suites is in Atlanta and Philadelphia, and I think they're going to DFW. I'm not sure if I'm making that up, but they're going to one or two other airports. So they're extending, and they're just small rooms where you can sleep or make a phone call in private or do some work or just have some quiet time at the airport. A lot of people also use them to change. You're going to do a business meeting, and so maybe you don't want to wear your good suit on the airplane, and so you need a place to change, and that is where people are using them for that.
You know, can I ask something about the restaurants that you've been seeing? Because you mentioned, you know, more airports believing that people don't necessarily want McDonald's, and that's great. But have you noticed, how's the pricing doing? I mean, I think it was... Wasn't it Pittsburgh that originally was one of those players in the idea airport restaurants more expensive than people might see on the retail market outside? I think it was Pittsburgh. It might not have been.
No, you're right.
Yeah, how's that going? I mean, it's certainly not happening at O'Hare, I can tell you that.
Well, more and more airports, what you want to look for, and you can look for it on their website, if you see street pricing, market pricing, it has to charge the same prices any place. A restaurant or a store can only charge the same price for what it sells for outside the airport. So I remember Pittsburgh especially because they invented this. I tested it on a 99-cent bag of pretzels, and it always cost 99 cents. So pricing or street pricing. Here in Seattle, they say even the a lot of like the coffee shops don't like it, but a Starbucks double latte costs the same at the airport as it does in town here.
Well, so but I guess the one question I never really understood was, were they simply marking it up because it was a bit of a captive market, or are their costs to running the businesses much higher at places like the airport?
Well, I think both. I think they marked it up because they could. Any place, any airport that doesn't have a street price rule will mark it up captive. But it does cost more because airport restaurants or airport shops have to have all their stuff go through security. It takes longer to get it through. It takes longer to deliver. It takes longer to get their garbage out, probably, as much as coming in. So I think there are extra costs. But I plan my travel and my shopping and my eating at airports where I know they're watching the prices. And they do, people go around and monitor those restaurants in those airports.
Hmm. What's your favorite airport? I mean, do you have one that just kind of jumps out and you go, oh, thank goodness I'm going to be stuck there?
Well, I always have two answers to that. My favorite airport is always the airport I'm at right before I get home.
That's a great answer.
And then in this country, I really try to sit at the San Francisco airport because at any one time, at least 20 art exhibits or history exhibits on display. And so there's something new all the time, and they're always interesting, and they're always educational. And there's good food in the international terminal. And now they've got a yoga room, which I've never used, but I'd like to see. So lots to do there. You? What about you?
Are you asking me or are you asking Max?
Both of you.
She's asking
either,
Rob.
I guess.
You guys.
Favorite airport? Ooh, boy, that's an interesting question. I'll have to think about that for a minute. I don't have a whole lot of favorite airports. I tend to think, well, I'm a pilot by profession, so I tend to only want to complain about the things that I don't like. It's in our nature. So, yeah. I mean, I can name half a dozen airports that I don't like and why. But that's an interesting question about which ones I do like. So, Max, while I'm thinking, what would you say to that?
Well, believe it or not.
Why is a guest asking us questions we don't already have answers to?
Hey, the tables are turned.
That's not supposed to be happening.
No, no. You know, this is going to sound crazy, but one of my favorites, at least domestically, is Chicago. But that's because I've spent, over the years, I'd spent so much time there. And it's almost for sentimental reasons that I like Chicago.
Which one? Do you mean O'Hare?
O'Hare. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But you were talking about seasoned travelers. I bet there's things about that airport that you don't even know that are make it a good airport.
Probably.
So do you know that they have beehives on the property and that they're selling honey that they're making, that the bees are making on the property?
Yeah, I think I did know that. Yeah, that is pretty cool, huh? That's very cool.
So Get out of here. In Chicago?
The chapstick I'm using today comes from that airport and those bees.
Get out of here. I didn't know that. Wow. That is wild. I'd never... Where in O'Hare are they doing that? Anybody... Is it all the terminals or...
Well, the bees aren't in the terminals.
Well, no. I meant the honey. I meant...
That would be fun.
Yeah. Well, only for a few minutes.
I'm not sure exactly how many places they're selling it, but it's I think it's a company called Bee Suite. And it employs people who have come from prison, and it trains them to be beekeepers, and it gives them jobs, and it makes this really good, healthy product.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Oh, now I'm going to have to go back and check when I get off the airplane. Okay.
So, Harriet, you have an article coming out that's not out now, but it will be by the time. Our listeners are hearing this. What's coming?
So coming out tomorrow afternoon, I'm not sure when this airs, but coming out soonest is a story about my favorite things from the Travel Good show. I just had a story out about what was at airports before they were airports. Mm. And that story was had like JFK used to be a golf course. LaGuardia used to be an amusement park. Atlanta used to be a racetrack. So that was most recent. And I'm not sure what you're referring to, but I'm hoping to start gathering some stories about people's memories of their very first airplane rides.
Yeah, that'll be great. That'll be very interesting. You're right, we're doing something similar to that.
So do you want to talk about sequestration?
Oh, sequestration. You know, it's almost a shame that David's... No, actually, it's a good thing David's not here, because that nothing gets David's blood boiling more than that word sequestration.
I can't even say sequestration.
It's a really hard word to say.
Yeah. So I was going to ignore it. I was just going to assume that it was, you know, politics as usual, but it turns out that things are already happening. Things are already getting canceled, and it's already causing trouble. So I guess we have to pay some attention to it.
You posted I think it was in your blog about the Passport Day.
Passport Day. I mean, that's something that it's not cheap to get a passport, and it's not cheap to get a passport for you and your kids. It's not cheap to get a passport when you have to get it soon. So Passport Day is like a good thing that helps people save some money. And so because of sequestration, they've canceled the annual Passport Day at the official passport offices. Some libraries and city clerks will still be open this Saturday to do it. But the main offices that were planning to do it, it happened before, like 2 years ago. And it's just, that's just too bad.
So what was the idea with Passport Day? I mean, what's special about, you know, that one day?
I think to go to one of the passport offices, you need an appointment, and you need to have time in a weekday to go. So this was a Saturday when working all week can go. You didn't need an appointment, so sometimes you could just walk right up. Some places you had to wait in line, but you didn't need an appointment. and the $60 expedite fee, the extra fee that you would pay for appearing in person, I think, is what was waived.
Ah.
So that means $60 is significant, and a Saturday instead of having to take a day off or an afternoon off is significant.
Yeah, for sure.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that's the beauty of the entire sequestration mess, is that the Congress does nothing except, and then on top of it, we're the ones that are really going to pay the price, all the normal folk out here.
Yeah, and just some people who you know, you kind of don't think, or I'm sure they didn't think that it's going to have an impact on. In Seattle, we have the Blue Angels come by each summer. And I guess there were some communities that were planning on having the Blue Angels and come by in the next couple of weeks. Those have been canceled. So some big events are already losing pieces of their activities. So that's happening.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure you can. I know or believe if lines at some airports can get slower, but I guess some of that might. So this, you know, if you can qualify for TSA PreCheck or Global Entry or any of those things that get you through faster, this is the time to get your paperwork in order.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, good point. Okay, Harriet, can you tell our listeners all the places that folks can find you online?
Do we have that long?
Yeah, I know. This is quite a list. Yeah.
So every day I write something on my blog, which is called stuckattheairport.com. It's a thing I just do because it's the most fun. But I do a monthly column called At the Airport for USAtoday.com. And then occasionally, not on any regular basis, I've got features on NBCNews.com and MSN Travel, which is where the travel goods story will be tomorrow afternoon.
I see.
With really fun pictures of Felix the Cat luggage and things like that.
And I think you're on Twitter as well.
I am on Twitter at H. Baskus and Stuck at Airport.
Both. You have a Twitter handle for both. Great. And right. Baskus is Baskas.
Yes.
All right. Well, Harriet, want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast. It's always, airports always fascinate me because they're like cities, just self-contained little cities. And there's just so much that goes on there. And I think, you know, we just touched on it a little bit of it this episode, but there's certainly lots more to talk about when it comes to airports.
Yes, I really like it. I like hanging out at airports.
All right, so coming up, we have the Australia Desk from Steve and Grant. Now, those guys have been up at the Avalon show in Australia, and they've been producing a lot of content. So if you haven't seen that or listened to that, you want to check that out at plaincrazydownunder.com. But first, here's Stephen Grant with the Australia Desk.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, March 3rd, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 238, coming to you from Avalon 2013 at the end of day six. And, boy, Grant, are we exhausted or what?
What? and deaf, yeah.
Yeah, an interesting day. At least the sun came out. Of course, we've been very busy this week doing daily coverage all 6 days. The first day we got here, I thought we were going to be rained out, actually, but fortunately, by the end of the week, it's turned out. And as usual with an air show, I'm sunburnt.
Yes, it wouldn't be an air show if Steve wasn't sunburnt, or windburnt, or run off his feet, or ready to go home and maybe even try a full-strength beer.
Yeah, no, I think I'll try a full-strength beer, mate. I'll be out. There'll be no editing tonight if that happens. Also sitting with us here is Eamon Hamilton. Eamon, you're with Public Affairs with Airlift Group from the Royal Australian Air Force, and you've been looking after us all week. It's an easy job, isn't it, mate?
Yeah, it is.
We don't ask much, do we?
No, not at all. It's if there's something going on, we try and get you guys on it.
Eamon, our listeners should know, I keep talking about this Hercules ride, and it was Eamon that managed to sneak me onto that, so he's my best friend in the entire world.
Because he also managed to sneak you on the KC-30, it's because of him, you know.
Yeah, great guy. Eamon, how's it been for the RAF this week from a public affairs point of view?
Yeah, look, it's been great. We started off about at the media launch last Friday, where we brought in the C-17 and did a combined event with air shows down under. We hit a bit of a rough patch on Sunday night, and many of the listeners will be aware that we tried to do the flare drop off St Kilda. Unfortunately, there was a technical fault with the aircraft just after it left Richmond to come do the drop, so we had to let down the public for that occasion. Yes.
I was there.
I just want to pick up on a point with that, too. There was a lot of negative feedback and a lot of people saying, geez, I hope we don't have to go to war. I should make the point, these aircraft are coming in and out of war zones constantly.
That's right. And I got down there at about 7:45, and funnily enough, there was a good-looking sunset for a lot of the people to sort of turn around and start photographing, and then the Melbourne City skyline behind that, and then the penguin colony. Where'd that come from? For anyone that stuck around after dark, it was it wasn't too bad a consolation. But so we got off onto a sort of a shaky start, but then got rocked up here at Avalon on Monday afternoon to bright skies, sunny conditions, high-level Raptor display, thinking we're going to have a pretty good run here, and then came back out for the quagmire on Tuesday.
And the rains came in on Monday night.
That's right.
You know what they say about Melbourne weather. If you don't like it, just wait an hour or so and it'll change.
That's right. Six seasons in a week wouldn't be Avalon without it.
Absolutely. Now, of course, I guess the big announcement this week has been to do with the KC-30, and they announced this week, the Minister, in fact, announced that it has reached IOC and can now start tanking operations for real, with at least with the probe and drogue.
That's correct, yeah. It's also, IOC also covers us for strategic airlift, and you look at, I mean, if you take away the refueling equipment, the aircraft's an incredibly capable strategic airlift platform, being able to carry 8 pallets of cargo underneath the decks, up to 36 tonnes, and then 270 guys on the top. And I think in past, the only ever time we'd even considered reaching figures of those sorts on a RAF aircraft, on a RAF transport aircraft, was when we overloaded Herxt in evacuation operations back in the good old days. So being able to carry them in relative comfort where they need to go is going to be well looked forward to by the guys and girls.
I tell you what, it must have great weight and balance compensation on the autopilot on that aircraft, because when we were up there in the sky and those Hornets came in to start taking on fuel, I think every journalist in the aircraft lurched instantly to one side.
Yeah, I think the guy that wrote the software for the autopilot earned his keep that week.
Must be in journalist mode, I think, on the autopilot.
Right. That's
the flight director. Yeah.
I got to say, the business class seats up the front were kind of nice. I get that's not for the grunts, is it?
No, well, it's funny the way it works out, because even if you've only got a little group of people going somewhere on it for a refueling mission, you think, there's 30 business class seats up the front and only 20 of us travelling, therefore we'll be able to enjoy a bit of luxury. But they still play the weight and balance card pretty seriously, as you'd sort of need to, and they get every pound out of that aircraft and make sure it's in the right place when they go up. So obviously when it's in the cruise, you're free to move around a little bit, but for takeoff and landing, you better take your designated seat.
any excuse to keep us away from those business class seats.
We know
they're reserved for crew.
They've still got that new jet smell.
Now, Eamon, of course, an event like this for the Royal Australian Air Force and for defence in general, it's obviously a great showcase here and very useful for recruiting for you guys. I guess that's a big focus when you come to an event like this.
That's right, and it's also about showcasing some of the capabilities. So obviously with the media flight on Wednesday with the KC-30, a little bit of bemusement from some of the media in Melbourne wondering why we weren't doing the C-130, but it was really good to take them out on the aircraft, a day after it's done the IOC declaration, and actually show these people the capability that the aircraft's here to sort of execute. Normally we don't sort of get to do that down here. Melbourne's very much accustomed, I guess, to the Air Force Band and the roulettes and other sort of high-profile events, but getting them to show them an actual capability is good, and carrying that through to Avalon. So we saw the Super Hornets and a bit of a demonstration of what they're capable of, the Orion doing its thing, people have been in and out of the Hercules and C-17 and getting a bit of an appreciation for what those things do the other 11 months of the year.
Now, we should mention, if anybody's been watching our videos this week, you might have seen a brief cameo from Eamon as we did our best impersonation of flying high, even though I stuffed it up at one point. But, very good job, mate, very good job.
That's right. That's the other part about having a tanker aircraft back on strength. I can now resume my flying high impressions on media jobs.
You do a very good job. Any one of you in public affairs, mate. Well, Eamon, today we really appreciate you looking after us this week. You guys have really supported us here at Plane Crazy Down Under and allowed us to get some fantastic material, mate. I appreciate your support.
Yeah, not a problem.
Now, of course, Eamon just mentioned briefly there the F-22 Raptor, and of course, it's been just thrilling people this week. I tell you what, you know, David always talks about how he's seen it so many times, but it's the first time that crowds have seen it here flying in Australia. And I tell you what, Grant, that aircraft does some things that no aircraft should be able to do. We were lucky enough to get out on the ramp and talk to the pilot, Major Henry Schontz. Here's a brief clip of what he had to say about the display.
The demo, it's about 15 minutes, and it's about 12 maneuvers to 13 maneuvers right there. It's great. You know, you go to take off, and like I said, you throw those engines up to max AB, roll down the runway, you're off the runway in about 1,000 feet, and you suck up the gear, and then when we get up to our speed of about 250 knots, we're going to go straight uphill. At that point, I'm just going to climb it out to around 3,500 feet, flop it over itself, and point straight back down to the earth, do a 360-degree roll, and then we're back out. Beyond that, we'll come back in and we'll do a min radius turn right there. So coming in about 420 knots or so. And then at the end of that 360-degree turn in front of the crowd, we'll go ahead and do a Cobra maneuver. So pull the jet straight up into the vertical and then go ahead and nose forward. Once we get back to level flight, I'll go ahead and I'll turn that jet 180 degrees around, what we like to call the J turn. Pretty much it's a high alpha maneuver where we just go ahead and kick the nose back around. It looks like a pirouette almost. Come out of that. We show the bottom of the jet, the weapons bay doors. We open them up so people can see where everything hides, because we do fly with a very clean profile. And then after that, I do the dedication pass. The dedication pass is pretty much, we just show the top side of the jet, come by at about 0.8 to 0.9 Mach and make some noise as we go by. But it's dedicated to, you know, the troops and our joint and coalition partners that have sacrificed over the years. After that, we come back in. I'll aim back at the sky again and do a 360-degree roll. I'll flop it over itself again at the top, and then I'll do a 360-degree pedal turn, what most people like to call the flat turn, you know, what looks to be a flat spin. I'll turn that around in a 360-degree motion and then exit back out. On a really strong wind day like today, I have the option of also going 180 degrees, stopping the turn, and going 180 degrees back, which is probably what we'll wind up seeing today.
Well, mate, you know, I've got to say, I've seen the Raptor about three, maybe four times now. I think, yeah, four times. And in fact, today I was watching the show from the upper hatch of the USAF C-17. We were over there doing an interview for them, and I just finished, and the other boys were getting some stock footage and getting some of their own, you know, the Ben and Ben show in the cockpit. And one of the guys was up on the hatch enjoying, and I happened to mention, oh, it's a good view, isn't it? And he said, yeah, come on up. So we didn't actually get out of the hatch, of course. We just stood in there. So I was about torso up out of the hatch enjoying the view, watching the Raptor do its tail slide. But there's one thing I've got to say. I'm a little concerned about this whole sequestration thing. Have we just blown the budget for the Raptor and we've seen it? And, you know, David, are you going to see it again?
I would just say that's a very wise investment of US taxpayer dollars if that's the case.
Yeah, because now I've seen it four times. David's seen it a whole lot more times. But at least I've caught up closer. And if they sort of cancel a Raptor show, well, you know, I don't feel as bad as not having, as if I hadn't seen it at all.
Yes, I tell you what, it's been fantastic. Well, folks, if you want to catch all our coverage from Avalon 2013, we've put out a show each and every day. That's episodes 101 through 106. And boy, that's been a lot of work, McHaren, I tell you. But we better finish this because they're about to kick us out of the media centre.
Yeah, that's right. We may be sitting around here on Eamon's golf cart, but he's enjoying some sun. And we sort of walked around the corner and bounced him, but we better get back, pack up and head out.
So coming to you from the last day of Avalon 2013. Until next week when we're back in the studio, I'm Steve Vischer.
I'm Eamon Hamilton.
And I'm Grant McHaren.
Cheers, folks.
Wow. Those guys had just too much fun.
They must be exhausted.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's tiring enough to spend that much time in a show like that, but when you're doing that and just constantly pumping out that kind of content, it's really, really wearing. So I really want to thank those guys for coming back home and somehow squeezing out an Australia desk for us this episode. So hats off to those guys.
Yeah, maybe if we play our cards right, they'll invite us next year and we could go over there.
Ah, oh, I would love that. We have a, when we coming up in the listener mail, we have a picture of the F-22, actually a couple of pictures of the F-22 sent from Mick, and we're for sure going to put those in the show notes, so watch for those. All right, now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond. He continues his Southampton Airport mini-series, and he's talking to the airport fire service. Here's Peter.
We returned to Southampton Airport this week to learn about its emergency services, and I'm joined by watch manager Ross Allen. Ross, welcome to Across the Pond.
Yeah, hello. How you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Ross, can you run us through what your role at the airport is and what your team's capabilities are?
Certainly. Well, my role within the fire services is as a watch manager. I report into the station manager as part of the management team. Between the two of us, we look after like the incident management side of any incidents that we would be asked to deal with at the airport.
Right.
Predominantly, they are around aircraft-related incidents, but that may extend to a range of different calls which we see, really. So.
Right, okay. And how many personnel do you have covering the airport, and what are their roles?
We've got a total of 33. Balances out roughly around sort of 11 per watch. We've got one station manager, one watch manager, two crew commanders, and a minimum of 4 to 5 firefighters on each watch.
Right. And do you all have specialist roles within the team?
Well, whilst we're all trained to the same level where we all become monitor operators, which fire the water cannons, and we go through the process, the guys also have to become qualified drivers. Once you've been there through your probationary period, you then get invited to attend like instructors' courses that could be within like a breathing apparatus discipline or a road traffic accident discipline. So you can sort of specialise in certain areas there, and then you become instructors responsible for then training the rest of the watch within those areas itself.
Okay, and everyone has a certain basic level of skills to operate the equipment that you have here.
Yeah, as I say, it's part of the probationary period. The first 11 months, they'll be taught the way of life, the way of a firefighter's life as an airport firefighter. As I say, it's quite a specialist role. And because we have specialist vehicles as well, as you've probably seen, quite different to our local authority counterparts, you know, it's quite a diverse role, really.
Yeah. So. And you've got some very impressive, relatively new equipment. Can you tell us about some of the vehicle tenders you have and their capabilities?
Yeah, we've got two Rosenbauer Panthers, which, as you say, we've just had them just over a year now. They're still like frontline major foam tenders.
Yep.
They're capable of producing around 5,000 litres per minute to, you know, an aircraft incident to a fire, say, which enables us to gain and establish control quite early on.
Yeah.
And because we've got two of those, there's quite a capacity there. They each hold in just over 12,000 litres of water and just over 1,500 litres of foam.
And they carry a crew of up to
The actual major foam tenders, there'll be two people on each of those.
Right.
Because the new vehicles can be controlled fully internally, so they can control the actual monitor and the joystick from the actual internal workings.
So they don't have to come out of the vehicle?
They don't stand outside. It's all controlled by a joystick.
Right.
The actual capabilities, these new vehicles have got thermal imaging capacity, so you can actually look out what's on there for heat sources, whether it be from a fire or actually it could be people which are hidden by smoke, so they would also be showing through the smoke as well.
Right, okay. And are these fast?
They do travel pretty quick. They need to. We need to maintain certain speeds as part of our regulation from the CAA, so we need to be able to maintain. They are checked on a monthly basis, which we enjoy doing. So.
And do you have response times to reach certain parts of the airfield?
Yeah, we have response times for the vehicles to get all parts of the area where aircraft, park or taxi extended to each end of the runway. The actual times for that are 2 minutes, not exceeding 3 minutes. That's in optimum visibility and surface conditions. So if there's any moisture in the air or the ground slightly wet, then that sort of goes out the window a bit. And we then drive to the conditions because obviously there's always going to be a safety element. So.
Yeah. And have you had any emergencies to deal with?
We've had, since I've been here, we've had a few incidents. Fortunately, we don't get too many major incidents. But, I've had a few which have been through the cause of issues with the aircraft, technical issues, which have thankfully resulted in no major issues, but we're always on standby basically to respond. So.
And how do you maintain that immediacy and that readiness to always be available for those responses?
The equipment are well maintained, whether it be the actual equipment is checked on a daily basis, the actual vehicles are checked on a regular pattern and undergo regular servicing and maintenance. And as far as the actual firefighters go, we comply with CAP 699 framework, which is our training framework, laid out by the CAA and endorsed by the CAA. And it basically allows us to ongoing training. It's done over a 4-yearly period where we'll undergo certain assessments within certain disciplines, and we need to maintain our skills on a constant basis.
Yeah, and as we know, you've even got your comms unit with you now, so always aware and ready. And how do you work in partnership with other emergency services around the airport?
We look to run exercises, whether it be a large-scale annual exercise where we are required to work with our the local authorities, whether that includes ambulance, police and fire. So we'll do that at least on a biannual basis. But where possible, we'll look to conduct tabletops where we can incorporate all the emergency services. So we're all sort of working towards one goal and we know what sort of capabilities each has got, really, to get the best out of any given incident or operation in which we may be required to deal with.
Well, it certainly feels very safe looking at those very nice tenders that you've got out there. Ross, thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Peter sent along a photo of one of these firefighting vehicles.
Did you see that thing? Looks like a spaceship.
It looks like something from a sci-fi movie. That is the coolest thing I have ever seen. Right, we're gonna put that in the show notes for sure. So folks, take it. Well, it's red because it has to be red because it's a big fire truck. But it's got this huge glass bubble in the front and this giant cannon on the top. It just looks 6 wheels. It looks really cool. It looks really fantastic.
I'd love to know what that cost.
Oh, yeah. Probably, that's probably not
cheap. A couple of bucks,
but it's a gorgeous vehicle. Really nice. So thanks to Peter for doing the Across the Pond segment and continuing the Southampton Airport miniseries.
Hi, guys. Steve Tupper from the Airspeed Podcast and the president of the Rob Mark Fan Club. You're listening to the Airplane Geeks.
Okay, now I think it's time for something really fun. And no, we're not bringing back Dan Webb. Oh. That would be too much on people. We've got a great story from Micah, our main man, and I think people are going to love it.
To tell the story of my first flight, I need to tell you a little bit about my family. Many listeners know of my mother, Harriet, who left us last June as an octogenarian airplane geek. But this story involves my paternal grandfather. My grandpa Max lied about his age to join the Navy. The Navy believed he was born in 1896. Being that his government birth record was destroyed in a fire many years before his death, and he lied about his birth year for so long, even he was never sure of the truth. No one ever knew if he was really born in 1897 or 1898. Part of his Navy training included sailing the square-rigged USS Constellation, built in 1854, to her final resting point in Baltimore. He was part of the Mexican campaign in 1914, serving on board the USS Celtic off the coast of Veracruz. In 1916, as a water tender on board the armored cruiser USS Tennessee, later rechristened Memphis, he sailed down the east coast of South America, through the Straits of Magellan, up the west coast, and through the then-new Panama Canal. During World War I, he was assigned to 4 Piper destroyers in the North Atlantic. After leaving the Navy, Grandpa Max joined the Merchant Marine and retired from there when he married Grandma Sadie. In 1966, he developed an inguinal hernia and needed surgery. While he was recovering in the hospital, my father found a newly published book, The Wreck of the Memphis, and gave it to him as a get-well gift. The armored cruiser, USS Memphis, formerly the USS Tennessee, was picked up by a tsunami on August 29, 1916, and cast ashore onto the rocks of Santo Domingo. Although Grandpa Max was not on board at the time, he did serve on her during her previous cruise and just before her rechristening. While an educated man, Grandpa Max was not an avid reader, but he tore through that book and found there was an organization of former shipmates called the Survivors of the USS Memphis. Now, Grandpa Max had always enjoyed traveling by bus. He had taken Greyhounds from New York to California to visit his brother, to Chicago for the Survivors of the USS Memphis reunion in August of 1967, and with me to the next reunion in August 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. In 1968, civil rights had not spread much below the Mason-Dixon line, and Grandpa Max could not abide by the segregation instituted by the bus lines. After that trip, he vowed to never patronize him again. And based on that, he decided that for next year's reunion in New Orleans, we would fly. Fly? We would fly? I would fly? I was a 13-year-old boy who grew up loving airplanes. I had never flown before. I wanted to fly more than anything else in the world. I was never more excited in my life, and that excitement lasted for a whole year. I had prepped for my first flight, too. My father, who had served in the U.S. Army in World War II and was what he called a retread when he was recalled to duty as an officer in the U.S. Air Force Medical Service during Korea, he had told me that I may need to clear my ears, and he taught me how to do so. It was about 8 in the morning on August 26, 1969, when we left for the then-recently renamed John F. Kennedy Airport for our 10:30 flight. I don't even remember checking in, but I do recall climbing aboard a Delta Airlines 707. We took our seats on the port side, and we had the whole row to ourselves. We were ready for takeoff. We taxied, made our takeoff roll, and soon we were airborne. I was looking out the window the whole time. I was flying! I must have had an ear-to-ear grin. When we leveled off, I cleared my ears just as my father taught me. Now, Grandpa Max, who had been rather quiet since the takeoff roll, looked at me, and with an urgent tone in his voice, almost shouting, said, "Do you need the oxygen?" And at the same time, he wedged his fingernails under the oxygen mask panel in the bulkhead and pried it open. He was reaching for a mask when I told him that I was just clearing my ears. Grandpa Max slammed the panel closed and looked at me with clear relief on his face. A few minutes later, the stewardess came by and asked if we wanted anything. I remember being quite startled when Grandpa asked for a double Jack Daniels. Now, I knew he occasionally enjoyed a drink, but never at 11 in the morning. This was another first. Now, almost 45 years later, when the airplane geeks asked listeners about their first flight, well, I reflected back on that day and had two revelations. In hindsight, I should have recognized these two things at the time, and you may already know what I'm referring to from my story so far. The first? Well, I got to share an experience with Grandpa Max. I got to share his first flight. Here was a man who served in the U.S. Navy when they still had sailing vessels. A man who had witnessed powered flight become a reality, and I had the chance to fly with him at 30,000 feet. I was so wrapped up in my own first-time flying experience that I didn't realize what I was sharing with him at the time. The second thing, and something that I never saw him before or any time after, even when he was dying of cancer, Grandpa Max was scared. Of course, it makes sense now, but think about it. My Grandpa Max, 71 years old, maybe 73, was able to overcome his fears and fly for the first time in his life to take his grandson to New Orleans and meet with old shipmates. For the first time ever, at 11 a.m. on Thursday, August 26, 1969, with the help of two little bottles of Jack Daniels on his tray table and the power of a Boeing 707, Grandpa Max and I were flying. Well, that's the story of my first flight. Perhaps not very different from others, but one I will never forget. Thanks for letting me share it with you.
Well, I really enjoyed that. And, you know, the one thing I've noticed about our listeners, of course, maybe it's because he's our main man, but he's a good storyteller.
Yeah, he is.
You
know,
Mike, I'm not just saying this to make you feel good, bud. I mean, you are a good storyteller, and I hope we can get more people. Well, I don't know if they could be as good as Micah, but gee, maybe we get people a try.
Yeah, and we have some lined up, too. We have Jesus Calderon. We have his story. We have David in Augusta's story, one from Vernon Tryon that just came in. And I think, Rob, you haven't seen it yet or listened to it yet, but just today, later today, we got another story from a listener. So we really love getting these, and we'll keep doing them.
Yeah.
All right, now it's on to some of the listener mail we received. I mentioned earlier that we got some photos from Mick, who was at Avalon. Mick sounds like quite a character, but he got some great shots of the F-22, so look at airplanegeeks.com for those. And he got to see the B-52. Mick says, "Oh, I got to touch a B-52. They had it parked and the bomb bay doors open. You could crawl under the wheels, in the wheel well, in the bomb bay door. It was grouse." Is that what he says? Is that like Australian for something?
I don't know. We probably need to get Steve or Grant on the line to interpret.
I guess so. Well, Mick also says, he says it's rubber coated, just like a stud on a Saturday night. That's pretty funny. I couldn't believe how small the bomb bay is for all that aircraft, but I guess it's about delivery. He says, I'm a bit excited about the B-52 today, having finally seen it closer than 100 yards. It looks small close up. So he's got some other observations. He mentioned the C-17 had some issues, at least for one. I guess it was a demonstration flight. They got those resolved and continued on maybe the next day. I'm not sure. So thanks to Mick for sending that along. Micah also sent us an email. He was asking about crashes at air races, even with no spectator injuries, and why do we stop the race in that situation? But in a auto race crash like the Daytona 500, where there were crowd injuries, but in that case the race continues the next day. And how come there's a difference? I'm not sure I know the answer, but it's kind of an interesting question. Any thoughts, Rob?
No.
I think it's about money. When you have a race like the Daytona 500, there is so much money involved in all aspects of that TV. I mean, it's the whole thing that, I don't know, maybe that the show has to go on. Maybe it's not the same with an air race. I mean, certainly they're not inexpensive. Certainly there's not, you know, no money that's associated with that, but it's in a different class. So, but I'm really not sure. But maybe if our listeners have some thoughts. And we also heard from Adam, another Aussie. But we get a lot of emails from the Australians. They write a lot, don't they?
Yeah, well, you know, they live out in the middle of nowhere. They don't really have much else to do.
Yeah, that's right. All that open space.
Well, I mean, what else are they going to do? Listen to Stephen Grant?
You can only do so much of that, right?
That's right. That's right.
So anyway, Adam says he says, I was interested to hear that thrust reversers can only be deployed when the plane is on the runway. And he says it put me in mind of Lauda Air Flight 004, which was a 767, which tragically broke up over Thailand due to an uncommanded reverser deployment. So that was an interesting case. There was some controversy, I think, with that accident as to just what happened and how it happened. I remember the black boxes, I think, were destroyed. It was such a violent situation. Another interesting thing is Niki Lauda himself got involved in the investigation, and he even went into the flight simulators to try to recreate the accident. Lauda, of course, being a pilot as well as a former amazing Formula One driver.
Well, I mean, that Lauda thing, I mean, the key in that accident report was the uncommanded. And, I mean, reversers are not supposed to be able to be deployed in the air because the change to the configuration, not to mention the stress on the wings from those things, those clamshells opening, it probably just ripped the airplane apart. It probably tore the wings off and everything else. And that's why that there is that squat switch, as we call it, on the on most airplanes, because we do not want to run the risk that will ever happen again.
That's right. We also heard from Terry Reese, Captain Terry Reese. If that name sounds familiar, it's because quite a while ago we talked about his book, Flying North, East, and West, which is an amazing book. We've had a lot of book recommendations, and I'm surprised I haven't thought of this one until now. This guy is an incredible, interesting pilot who did a lot of bush flying in Alaska, went on to do some other things with C-130s and some operations that were, well, I guess you would call them covert, ended up being a 737 pilot, if I recall correctly. It's a great book. It's a great story. But he has a new book out. And this is called Glory Hole, Enjoy the Flight. And it's a aviation action adventure story. And I think it's, just based on his previous work, it's probably something that we should take a look at. There's a Kindle edition of this book, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's a fictional aviation adventure book. But, some of the themes that really sound like things that we know about Captain Reese's life. So I think it's going to be a good read. And we also heard from Jody Bromer, our guest from a few episodes ago. She said that she had her commercial check ride finally. She said it went very well, even though leading up to it was just short of complete and total chaos.
Always is.
Always is. Yeah, she says a little less than 36 hours to prepare and a logbook that was at the binders. She said, I flew my last remaining hours to be eligible for the check ride only 2 hours before the DPE showed up, which was nice for my flight skills, but hell on my stress levels. She says it all turned out great and only proved my opinion that in aviation, you can count on nothing and everything happening never and all at once. So congratulations to Jody.
Yeah, absolutely. And on top of it, she did it in a helicopter, as you say.
Yeah, neat. Very neat. Ian Kershaw sent in a photo of a Sopwith triplane. That was David's airplane last week. He says that there's one in Calgary, and sent a link to a picture of that airplane, which is really gorgeous. So thanks, Ian, for sending that along. And here's someone that we haven't heard from in quite a while, Ron Klutz. Do you remember Ron?
Oh, my goodness. Captain Ron!
Ron said, he says about the no fly-by-wire accidents. He said, there was the Airbus that went into the forest at an air show early in its career. While it wasn't a passenger flight, wasn't the problem due to the flight computer software and the configuration of the airplane and the computers thought it was landing and didn't allow the go-around power to be passed on to the engines. So this was Air France Flight 296, I think it was, Rob.
Yeah, well, leave it to Captain Ron to tell me when I blew it. Actually, he's absolutely right. I completely forgot about that one. And that was captured. Now, it isn't worse. It was captured on video.
Yeah.
And you see that poor Airbus sailing along at about maybe 30 feet above the ground, and you expect it to start to climb,
and
it never does.
Yeah.
It just disappears in the trees.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you for pointing that out, Captain Ron.
Yeah, we'll put a link to the YouTube video of that in the show notes. You when you see it, you'll remember it. It's kind of a dramatic video. Randy sent us an email. You know, we've talked about the Piaggio, and we've talked about sort of the sounds that it makes, the unique sounds that it make. Well, Piaggio is built a drone version, an unmanned version of this aircraft. It's based on the Piaggio there. And it's kind of an interesting-looking craft. And we traded a little bit of email, and Rob, it occurred to me that, you know, maybe this is a great opportunity for business aviation, general aviation aircraft manufacturers. There seems to be a lot of interest, a lot of activity in the drone world, and, you know, maybe this represents a viable business model for some of them.
That's an interesting question. Of course, I know the Piaggio people have been at work on this airplane to use it as a remote control machine for quite some time. They had a demonstration of it down at the National Business Aviation Convention last fall down in Orlando. And I thought it was pretty cool then. But, of course, we had not seen the picture of it completely covered up. And yeah, for people that haven't seen it, it's a Piaggio, then there are no windows.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just
very strange.
It does. And not just that they covered up the existing window openings, right? It looks like there's some, you know, some new bodywork over what would have been the cockpit.
Yeah, it's Bondo.
It's Bondo.
It's just like what we used to use on my old cars.
Okay, Bondo. Yeah, yeah. Scott sent us a photo of a Polish Lot 787 on the ramp in Chicago, just sitting there lonely by itself waiting for something to happen. And it's a nice little shot. He got that. I think it's out of the window of I'm not sure where he shot this from, but it's a great little photo. We'll put that photo in the show notes. We got lots of pictures this time, Rob, and they're all great. Bob sent us a picture from the helicopter museum, and I forget what kind of helicopter this is.
I'm really bad at helicopters anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know my helicopter. I know the Robinsons, but that's because I flew in one.
Oh, I was going to say I saw that movie. I mean, you know, with Mrs. Robinson.
With Mrs. Robinson, you know. That's different, right?
That's a, yeah, okay, I guess, okay.
Young Lim wrote us. He's from Singapore. And this is pretty interesting. He says, hope everything is fine and well with you guys. Just want to share with you. He says he's applied to be the first local to be part of the space program in Singapore. Singapore's decided that they are going to, you know, try to make some inroads in regards to space. And so he sent an article from Asia One. I'll put that link of that in the show notes as well. And he's gotten himself involved in that. And in the response back to him, Rob, what I said is maybe Young Lim will be the first Airplane Geeks listener to go into space.
Well, I would say it's about time. I think we do need to start expanding.
I think so. So that's that would be very exciting. So I think Young Lim, keep us informed. Singapore, of course, has a very developed aviation industry, and there's a lot of companies and businesses in Singapore. It's a great location for that kind of thing. Many manufacturers and others are there, have joint ventures, or there's Singapore companies that have very good maintenance capabilities with worldwide reputations. So, it's interesting to see that Singapore is going to go look at the space business. Very good. So, Rob, we need to close this one out, but we didn't have a chance to talk about the conference. So maybe, what do we think, next week?
Oh, I think we should. I mean, I'll be back by then, and I can have quite an interesting rundown. I mean, the first day alone, I think, was really interesting. But then I like all this airplane geeky stuff that these people talk about. So.
Yeah. And we want to thank our guest, Harriet Baskus. You can find her on Twitter as HBaskus, or you can find her at her blog, stuckattheairport.com.
And she's not really stuck at the airport right now.
I bet she doesn't get stuck. I bet she only gets stuck at the airport when she wants to.
You know, I'll bet you're right. That's something we should have asked her. Harriet, get back on so we can ask you that question.
That's
a great question.
And we also want to thank our contributors, as always, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Go visit them at planecrazydownunder.com and look at the content they've got from the Avalon show. Also want to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segments. You can find him on Twitter as NASCOT Hornet. You can find him on Facebook as XTP Media. And, of course, his Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on Extended. All right, Rob, why don't you tell everybody where they can find more Rob Mark?
Well, they can find me at jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter. Let's see, Jetwine on Facebook. Who knows where else? All kinds of places. And, of course, that's assuming I ever come back from San Diego because,
as I said,
it's just in time to miss all the snow back in Chicago. But
yeah.
I'm sure I'll be back next week.
Probably your wife will have it all shoveled out by the time you get home.
Oh, yeah, right.
Oh, maybe not, huh? All right, and I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus as Max Flight, also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 238. Find lots of photos and links to all the sites that we mentioned. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com if you'd like to stream us right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Benay, what's the number?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
So the news item is that JetBlue.
That's a good one. We're going to put that one in the outtakes.
Oh, my. Well, the advantage, Rob, to getting old, like people like us, is that we don't care so much what we look like.
Oh.
Don't you find that to be true?
Sure, Max.
Oh, maybe it's just me.
Right.
Running up and down the motorway. Do you, that wasn't sense, was it, Peter Johnson?
Who knows? Maybe next week David will show up for work.
He better show up for work.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need David. I mean, we need some history going here.
Well, we have some history with David anyway, but we'll save that part for when we turn off the show.
Okay.
Bye.
All right, we're out.